Today is March 5th. Am I mad? Only March Madness. But there's baseball to talk about, too. Welcome to the WGBB Sports Break. We're sponsored by Harbor Links in Port Washington. Hey, speaking of March Madness, it's followed by April in the Masters. And then we're talking about great golf being par for the course. Also sponsored in part by Borelli's in East Meadow, serving great Italian food since 1955. By Fifth Printing, the right people, the right printing. And by the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club in Massapequa. Get yourself into shape for spring and summer activities at the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club in Massapequa. March Madness has officially begun, and we'll talk about that, plus baseball prospectuses. Jay Jaffe coming up in just a moment. This is the Sports Break. Hi, I'm Joel Blumberg, host of the Sports Break, and as many of you listeners know, I recently lost a lot of weight. Most importantly, I've been able to keep it off, and as a result, I feel great. While I exercised by playing golf during the warm weather months, I needed something when golf was not available. Well, now I found it at the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club in Massapequa. The mission at Sunrise is to help you achieve your fitness goals by providing a positive, supportive, and comfortable fitness environment. Whether it's getting involved in the racquetball program, starting a fitness routine, or enjoying a group exercise class, their staff is there to assist you in every step of the way. The Sunrise Health and Racquet Club is located on Sunrise Highway in Massapequa, just across from the Sunrise Mall. And find out how you can get a free week by logging on to sunrisehealthclub.com. You too can start feeling great at the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club. The East Coast Conference crowned its men's and women's champion yesterday, and congratulations to the Lady Chargers of the University of New Haven for winning the ECC Women's Division for the second consecutive year. Ashley Hilton and company under new coach Jessica Smith goes to the NCAA, where they'll probably go up against Southern Connecticut State, their neighborhood rival. And congratulations to the Adelphi Panthers. Adelphi coming out of the fourth seed in the ECC, barely getting that fourth seed with a win in their final home game, getting home court advantage for the first round and then sweeping up at Bridgeport. Their second consecutive ECC championship. They'll go to the NCAAs as well. More than likely at the University of Bentley University, where they go up against a team that's 29-0 in their first-round NCAA matchup. But congratulations to those two schools. Tonight, Niagara and Siena battle for the Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference crown, and it's too bad for the Marist Red Foxes because 24-7 and not getting into the final game. A great year, final game of the year, for final season for one of the great point guards in the country, Jared Jordan. And it's not going to happen for him. He's not going to the NCAAs because Siena or Niagara, in fact, are going to go. But March Madness is underway. Big East tournament begins on Wednesday. The other majors, some on the way, some will be beginning this week. And by this time tomorrow, you and I, this time next week, we will be discussing, who deserved to go to the dance and who didn't deserve to go to the dance. But we're going to talk about baseball when we come back with Jay Jaffe of Futility Infielder and Baseball Prospectus. It's coming up in just a moment. This is the WGBB Sports Center.
PIP Printing and Document Services can create, print, and mail all of your important business documents, from direct mail to catalogs, brochures, sales materials, marketing collateral, and more. PIP offers you the convenience of handling every aspect of your project so that you can save your company time and money. You can even edit, revise, and place your order online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one else can offer all of these services, plus PIP's outstanding customer service. PIP Printing and Document Services, your complete document services solution.
See Mark Saltzman at PIP Printing, 85 North Broadway in Hicksville. Telephone number 516-942-9500. Borelli's Restaurant in East Meadow has been doing business since 1955. When Borelli's first started, the Dodgers were in Brooklyn, the Giants were in Manhattan, and there were no New York Islanders, no Nassau Coliseum, or no New York Jets to train at Hofstra. When you're around that long at the same place, run by the same family, there has to be a reason. And the reason is a simple one. Borelli serves great Italian food with great service at affordable prices. Borelli's is located on Hempstead Turnpike, just east of the Meadowbrook Parkway. It's across from the Nassau Coliseum and right down the road from Adelphi University. If you haven't been to Borelli's, then what's taking you so long? Once you do get there, it won't be another half century before you go back. Borelli's on Hempstead Turnpike, just east of the Meadowbrook Parkway in East Meadow. Family owned and operated since 1955. And welcome once again to the WGBB Sports Break. I'm Joel Blumberg, and as our custom, our March pilgrimage to baseball, and as I said in the beginning of the show, this is going to be it for baseball, because for the next 3 weeks, March Madness in basketball is going to be taking center stage. And with baseball, you got this 1 week as the tournaments go, so we're going to bring our good buddy Jay Jaffe of Baseball Prospectus on with us. And Jay, first of all, it's got to be, after all you've done during the course of the off season, or waiting for this time, now that pitchers, catchers, and batters have reported to spring training and they're actually playing exhibition games, you finally get moving a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's exciting. I had a very busy winter doing a lot of interesting and fun projects, and I, you know, in some ways, I kind of feel like that old Warner Brothers cartoon where Elmer Fudd stays up all night trying to get to sleep, but is bothered by every noise, and then the sun comes up and he realizes he's lost his chance to sleep. That's a little how I feel. I'm a little exhausted, but at the same time, it's fun to see all the stuff that you've worked on all winter kind of come into play, and you know, the theories that you hatched in December start playing out on the field in April.
Okay, what kind of theories have you hatched that have come to fruition this start of spring training season?
Well, I don't know that any of them have hatched yet, but for example, I wrote about the Dodgers and the Red Sox in Baseball Prospectus and just tried to outline where I thought they would go. You know, in terms of you know, whether the Dodgers youngsters can be competitive again. Whether the Red Sox can bounce back from what for them was a real debacle of a season, stuff like that.
What about as far as the local teams go?
As far as the local teams go, I think the Yankees have done some very interesting stuff. I think the way that Brian Cashman has, you know, shed a lot of payroll and restocked the team's pitching, you know, not just for now but for the future, I think is a very interesting break in the way that the Yankees have done business over the 30 years that George Steinbrenner has owned the team. This is the most forward-thinking that I've ever seen them.
How much do you attribute that to the fact that George Steinbrenner is not in the best of health, and it's very obvious that he's taken more of a back seat, and you got to wonder if, in fact, his son-in-law, who was involved in an incident that where the publicity was detrimental to the Yankees off the field, and Brian Cashman's real ultimatum, where a couple of years ago, if you don't give me more autonomy, I'm going to leave, and he was signed to a contract extension and was given more autonomy, and now you're seeing the fruits that this is born.
Yeah, exactly. I think the Yankees are in a very transitional period. The Steinbrenner has kind of taken a step back. They have a GM in place who, you know, can work with him still under these conditions, and who has survived the media circus that dominates Yankees coverage and has and always will, you know, in Brian Cashman. And Cashman, you know, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago made a very bold power play to kind of cut the authority of the Tampa group that was often undercutting him and, you know, leaking things to the press. And he made a bold power play and basically said, I'm in charge here, and so long as I'm here, we're doing this my way, or I'll get a job somewhere else. And you know, I think it'll be interesting to see whether it works, but I think whether or not the specifics of it actually work, I think it was philosophically the right move because the Yankees can't afford to go up to a $250 million payroll and not win a world championship with it.
Well, that being said, and that's the point that I wanted to explore with you, even though Cashman has got his autonomy and pretty much now is running the franchise, has he really produced not so much getting the Yankees to the postseason, but they've done nothing in the postseason? And the question is, has he produced enough to justify the autonomy that he has and to justify the faith that George Steinbrenner has put in him? And if he hasn't, is this now a watershed year for Brian Cashman?
You know, I think, first of all, the Yankees have made the playoffs now for, what, 11 straight years?
Yeah, but is making the playoffs enough?
No, just bear with me here. The Yankees have made the playoffs for 11 straight years. They have not been back to the World Series since 2003. They've come close in 2004. The last couple of years, they've been eliminated in the first round. The problem is, you know, is that a five-game playoff series is a crapshoot, and, you know, anything can go wrong. I mean, you saw Bubba Crosby and Gary Sheffield crashing into each other 2 years ago. You saw last year, the Tigers just rolled over them, and unfortunately, towards the end of the series, Joe Torre made some really unfortunate decisions in terms of playing time, you know, moving Alex Rodriguez down, taking Gary Sheffield out of the lineup. I mean, a lot of that, I think, comes down to the manager, you know, the manager's responsibility as much as the GM's. I mean, the GM can build a team that can hopefully go all the way. The manager, though, especially in the postseason, the manager's really got to take the reins. And I think, you know, if you're going to point fingers, I think Joe Torre's job in the postseason last year is probably as much or more responsible than for the Yankees not getting there as, you know, the way that Brian Cashman built the team.
That being said, and I agree with you, okay, Joe Torre did come under scrutiny for some of the managerial decisions that were made last year in the postseason. But, you know, you go even further back. The Yankees, 3 years ago in 2004, was the first team ever to lose a series after leading 3-0, and that of all people to the hated Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox have made some very progressive moves. Brian Cashman lost out on Daisuke Matsuzaka right now, and that's a negative, I think, as far as, you know, his administration. The Yankees used to get players like this. Now, whether this was a decision that was calculated, or a decision that just he didn't have a chance in getting, nobody really knows. But I guess the question I'm asking you is, you know, while all things said and good, these things didn't happen to the Yankees before. And all of a sudden, these things are happening now. And the question is, you're kind of implying that Joe Torre is in the hot seat, not Brian Cashman. I say when you come from above, it's still going to be Brian Cashman's neck on the line, and the truth of the matter is, Joe Torre has succeeded in managing the Yankees. Brian Cashman, in his stint with autonomy, has not, and that's the bottom line for Yankee fans and Yankee management.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think, though, you have to look back just a little bit and realize that, you know, part of the problems that the Yankees have had over the last couple of years is getting through this mess that basically was the Jarrett Wright and Carl Pavano contracts that, you know, were done before Cashman had autonomy and that totally didn't pan out and that have really hampered the Yankees' plans for starting pitching. I mean, they're trying to clear those problems now. So, you know, that's why Cashman has spent so much time trying to remake the rotation this offseason. I mean, I think you're right, though. I mean, in that Cashman is on the hot seat. I mean, this is his vision. This is his plan. I don't know that it's necessarily going to pay off 100% this year, but I do think that with, you know, Philip Hughes and these other youngsters that Cashman has acquired, that the Yankees are going to be in very good shape going forward, and that they're going to have young pitching that they'll develop that they won't be paying $20 million a year for.
And you know, to expand on that and maybe kind of like to close the book on the Yankees portion of this season, you look at the last two World Series winners, St. Louis Cardinals, middle of the road payroll, the Anaheim Angels, of course, middle of the road payroll. You're talking about teams that have not spent a lot of money in building their franchises. So maybe that's part of the master game plan that Brian Cashman has, is to, you know, reduce the payroll and hopefully you could still win.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just because you spend $200 million or $150 million or whatever does not guarantee you're going to win. In fact, you know, look at the Boston Red Sox last year. They were the most expensive team ever to not make the playoffs. I mean, you can't have that. And that's why the Red Sox, for example, spent so much on Matsuzaka. I mean, they have to justify that they're spending. I mean, there's a huge, you know, our studies at Baseball Perspectives show that there's a huge revenue bump that comes with making the postseason. It's a ripple effect that has, you know, that raises revenues as much as 10 years down the road, and it's kind of an exponential curve. And I'm sounding a little bit esoteric here, but the bottom line is you can't spend that much money on a team and not at least make a playoff. Whether you go further than that, though, you know, is sometimes up to fate and lady luck.
And I think that's what happened with the Red Sox last year, losing Jonathan Papelbon and losing some key pitchers and losing a couple of key players. That's going to do it every time. Not that the Red Sox had great pitching and great middle relief to begin with. Let's move on to the Mets, because we're talking about middle relief. And I think it's obvious that Omar Marino has really, if one area he has stressed with the Mets in his administration as the Mets general manager, he stressed middle relief and obviously a closer in Billy Wagner. I have this theory, and you and I have talked about this. I think the starting pitcher and the complete game pitcher is really going the way of the dinosaur. If you can get quality pitchers to give you five innings, you can win. I don't think people have subscribed to that theory fully yet, but that was the Mets' success last year. Not that they had great starting pitching. Pedro was a great starting pitcher, but he was only a five- or six-inning pitcher. I thought the most valuable part of the New York Mets team last year was the middle relief.
Well, absolutely. I think if you look at what the Mets did last year, a lot of it, as far as the way that the pitching staff actually ran, was very much patterned on the Angels in 2002, the world champion Angels, when they had just an absolutely dominating bullpen that, you know, if you got them to the sixth inning, it was game over, because they could just bring out like three or four arms and just shut you down. And the Mets, you know, I don't think they really necessarily planned to be quite in those, in that position, but, you know, they're starting pitching. They had so many injuries that they really had to, but, you know, to their credit and, you know, to the credit of Rick Peterson, their pitching coach, and Willie Randolph, the manager, they were able to, you know, to patch through it. And they did, you know, they were lucky in that they had a lot of different guys coming out of the bullpen that could, you know, give them different looks, like Chad Bradford and his sidearm, and, you know, Pedro Feliciano and Darren Oliver, you know, lefty-righty. I mean, they were able to get through it because they had such depth, even after they lost Dwanner Sanchez. And, you know, there's no question that is definitely having a good bullpen like that is a necessity, unless you've got guys who can go, you know, deep in the ballgame. And the Mets, to their credit, recognize that.
It's almost like, and you look at the offseason maneuvers that the Mets made, it almost is like Omar Moreno scanned the waiver wire every morning, and if the guy had middle relief experience, the Mets claimed him.
Well, you know, we've looked at this at Baseball Perspectives too, and you know, the guys that people are spending, you know, big dollars on in terms of the relief pitching aren't necessarily the guys who are going to produce this year. It is just as likely that somebody who you pull off the waiver wire is going to develop into a good relief pitcher this coming year as it is that somebody you're paying $4 million to. It's just, other than closers, you know, and other than the elite tier of closers, the Mariano Riveras, the Billy Wagners, you know, and a few other guys, most of these guys are fairly unpredictable from season to season, and investing heavily in them is a mistake.
Well, we'll see what happens. Do you like what the Mets are doing? Do you like the way the Mets have built their team? A lot of people say that the Phillies have gotten younger. They've got Ryan Howard. They've got a real good pitching staff. The Braves have got a real good pitching staff. The Mets are the defending National League East champions. They dethroned the Braves for the first time. Do you think the Mets can continue this way, or do you think the Mets are making a mistake getting older and spending more money?
Well, I think that, you know, I would like to have seen them, you know, shell out a bit more for one more solid starting pitcher, who, you know, maybe was a bit younger. But when you've got, David Wright and Jose Reyes locked up for several years now on contracts that after the new collective bargaining agreement are basically below market contracts, you've really laid a nice foundation in terms of the future of the ball club. And they've got, you know, they've got these pitchers, you know, Mike Pelfrey and Philip Humbert, and they're going to be, you know, they've got a good amount of youth coming in their direction too, and you know, Lastings, Millage, and you know, players like that. They've got a nice young nucleus that, you know, maybe it won't all gel this year. I mean, obviously David Wright and Jose Reyes are already there, but you know, as old as they are in, you know, in some areas, they're, you know, they've got a nice balance in others. So I think they'll be all right.
Quickly, final thing, steroids. Bud Selig is pretty much, I don't know, he seems to be vacillating on his position that he won't be around when Barry Bonds hits number 756. What do you think of the home run record? What do you think of the credibility of the home run hitters and performers in this steroid era? Is Bud Selig making the right move, or it is what it is? The guy hit 756. Some of your thoughts on that.
Well, I have very mixed emotions about it, and particularly very mixed emotions towards Barry Bonds. I believe that Barry Bonds used steroids. I think that there is a preponderance of evidence in that favor. At the same time, I also do believe that, you know, he is to some extent, you know, there's been an attempt to railroad him by the federal government. Now, that said, I don't want to see Barry Bonds break the record. I think it's extremely dubious. I don't wish him any good luck. And, you know, it's just going to be, I think it'll be a very dark day for baseball, and, you know, maybe deservedly so, when Barry Bonds breaks the record, because really it's Bud who dropped the ball in a lot of ways. It's the players' union who dropped the ball in a lot of ways. And it's just, you know, it's just going to be a sad and sobering day, when Barry Bonds breaks the record, because I think it's been delegitimized.
Barry Bonds is not a nice guy. Had it been Sammy Sosa or had it been Mark McGwire, and I picked those two personally to take race out of the issue, because Barry Bonds is playing the race card to some extent. So I take Sammy Sosa, who was a good guy, and I take Mark McGwire, who was a good guy. Do you think the opinion, and I feel the same way you do, by the way, I feel exactly the same way you do about Barry Bonds. Do you think our judgment is clouded by the fact that he's not a nice guy and he's an arrogant guy?
I think that there's something to that extent, but, you know, to me, a lot more of it comes down to what we know and what we know we don't know. Now, Mark McGwire, we have a lot of smoke around, around his situation in terms.
Let me stop you for one second, and I'm sorry, Jay. I don't mean to interrupt you, but let me paraphrase it by saying, let's say this would have been 5 years ago when Sosa and McGwire were on the Roger Maris breaking point. Those are the two athletes I refer to, not the athletes that we know of today.
Well, you know, certainly at that point in time, I mean, they were both, you know, fairly well loved, and, you know, at the same time, even then, there were a lot of signs that we should have been paying attention to in terms of, you know, the legitimacy of what they were accomplishing. But, you know, yes, they were both much more, for want of a better word, cuddly characters in the public eye than Barry Bonds ever was, and maybe the situation, you know, would have developed differently. But, you know, that's a difficult thing to say at this point. I think, you know, we're as we learn more about, you know, what those two guys may have done, I think that, you know, again, that kind of dampens our enthusiasm for their accomplishments and calls into question, you know, the joy that we had when we were watching them at that point.
He's the best. He's Jay Jaffe, a futility infielder in Baseball Prospectus. And, boy, he's got it all nailed down. want to thank our guest, Jay Jaffe, for joining us. Our program is brought to you by Harbor Links in Port Washington, where great golf will still soon be par for the course, by Borelli's in East Meadow, serving great Italian food since 1955. Also brought to you by the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club in Massapequa. Get into spring shape with the Sunrise Health and Racquet Club, and by Pitt Printing, the right people, the right printing. Till next week, I'm Joel Blumberg. We'll see you.